This is Dave the Game from CriticalHits.com. I happen to be sitting here with Mike Merles, one of the lead developers on 4th Edition. Mike, thank you for talking to me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
The game's out now.
Yeah,
couple weeks. Yeah, exactly. Bet that was a big thing.
Oh, yeah. It's a big weight off my back.
Yeah. So now that people actually have it in their hands and they're playing with it a bit, any reactions that you've gotten? What's been the overall feeling?
People seem pretty positive.
Yeah.
I think there's people kind of still getting their feet wet. It's a very different game, and I think people are still, like, we just had one guy saying about how, well, I don't like what you did to the wizard, but I really like the fighter now.
Right,
so,
right.
And I think people are kind of going through those sort of things.
Yeah.
You know, where the game is shifting, but what, you know, the goal really was, sure, we might change it, but hopefully everyone who loves the game still finds a reason to love it.
Right.
You know, and so it's been good to see, you know, the feedback's generally been really positive. You know, it's been good to the show. You get nervous when you go to a con, especially this close to launch.
Yeah, I know.
Are people going to be happy or sad or angry? And no, it's been pretty overwhelmingly happy, which feels good.
That's good. Yeah, that's so great. Did any of the hardcore 3.5 fans jump you at any point, drag you off?
I had one guy who's kind of angry. It was really weird. He, like, had his sort of objections, but there weren't things that I was like, well, okay, I could see why you might not like that, but I don't see them as things that most people would say, I won't play the game over those issues,
right.
You know.
Weird deal breakers.
Yeah, but it's kind of thing where, you know what, if people are playing 3.5 and they like it and that's what they want out of a game, then, you know, that's fine. You know, that's, people love you know, 3.5, you know, and so there's no reason. I'm sure there are people who still love it and want to keep playing it. So, hey, that's gaming, right?
There's
so many different things, ways to play that it's really up to you what you want.
Yeah. Do you have any advice for anyone sort of easing into the transition now?
Yeah, I think the important thing would be don't be afraid to sort of question the assumptions you're making about the game based on how earlier editions did things.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you need to go, okay, like with reach and attacks opportunity from 3.5 or, you know, preparing spells and things like that. I think people are tending to read a little too much into rules sometimes, where they'll look at an effect and they'll read it, but then they'll say, well, what about this situation? And sometimes it's kind of easy to say, well, to try to extrapolate instead of saying, no, but what does the rule say? The rule says, like, I can't think of an example off the top of my head. Maybe something like, oh, like, what if you are on fire? You know, like, you have ongoing fire damage, and there's, you know, someone throws oil on you. Should you take more fire damage? You know, it's like, well, the rule doesn't say you should. Your DM might say, sure, you're going to.
Right.
But, you know, it's easy to see the absence of rule as saying, well, there should be, that's a vacuum that needs to be filled right now with, like, an official rule or something. A lot of that's meant to be DM adjudication, things like that.
Yeah.
Just kind of, hey, that sounds like, because if we tried to make a rule to cover all those things, the game would be completely bloated.
It would be a huge rule say, yeah. I remember some people complaining specifically that they wanted to douse their tieflings in oil and set them on fire.
Yeah.
And there weren't rules for that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's where the DM comes in.
Yeah, there's always going to be the strange situations. So I played with you in a delve back at the D&D Experience, and I remember you were very, like, did a lot of evocative combat descriptions, like every round. You know, it was, the monsters don't just swing. You know, you actually described it, and when they took damage, you described it. Do you have any tips for doing that, and do you think 4th edition sort of works better, that sort of thing?
I think with the power system, especially for monsters, you know, what I do when I run my games, I really, especially making a new monster, I sort of picture in my head, what is this monster doing during the fight? And what do I want it to do story-wise, and the sort of movie in my mind of the fight? And then I make the rules to model what I watched, you know, in my head. And then I'll use that to draw on to say, here's what's happening. You know, you see this weird slime creature comes at you like a tidal wave and just washes over you, and it moves on, but you're still covered in acid that's burning into your armor, you know, things like that. So it really draws a connection between the mechanics and what's going on at the table, and it draws people in so they start thinking more, here's this imaginary realm we're adventuring in, and this is what's happening. It's not just rattling numbers off across the table.
Right.
So I think especially if you're prepping a session, one of the best things you can do is just look at the critters you're using and just jot down little notes of how you want to describe each attack, you know, and use that to really drive the action, to really evoke the feel of the game. And for players, I think it kind of goes the same way, too, where if you have your powers and stuff, you know, read that flavor text and think of, don't be afraid to change it to what you think your character would do, and use that yourself, too, you know, because the game is only as immersive as everyone makes it.
Right.
And I think that helps out when you're sort of looking at these rules and not just treating it like a piece in an abstract game, thinking about what's going on, what are the other players seeing, what are the characters seeing, what's going on in this scene.
Do you think there's going to be more supplements that are going to sort of say, you know, these powers can sort of have these other uses, or, you know, they can have these other flavors, or maybe even, you know, here's how you can represent it in other ways?
Yeah, I think that the, mechanically probably not, but that's something which we want to, as we're going forward, instead of, you know, getting people up to speed in the game, that's something that I think is really just comes down to DM advice. Mm-hmm. You know, just really trying to get people on board with that idea. Because there is a lot of things, like the flavor, everything that's in italics and the power is, you can put anything you want there.
Right.
And there are a lot of things like, if you change like the energy type of your spell, that doesn't really change the mechanically, the balance
right.
of that spell. Yeah, I had someone in a seminar this morning asking, like, well, what if I want to be a cold mage? Can I change all my fire spells to cold? And yeah, you know, that does not hurt the game in any way.
Interesting.
And that's the kind of good thing to hear. People, like, I want people to kind of think of the game that way, to start tinkering and personalizing a little bit. You know, because I think that's what makes D&D.
It's a really interesting game because, you know, a lot of people will do, like, small house rules to other sorts of games, but D&D is the one where it makes pretty much everyone playing a game designer in a way.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the strength of it. I think that's what one of its sort of enduring appeals.
Yeah.
And that's why you have things like a really simple monster creation rules that really emphasize more the creativity of the powers rather than churning through a lot of math to, you know, to just start the basic numbers before you even start adding the interesting stuff.
Right. So how easy do you think it is to take those monsters and sort of use them for non-combatant roles? Like, I know D&D buddy of mine from college, you know, really liked a lot of the stuff going on, but was kind of upset that there weren't any gold dragons because he really wanted, you know, like a gold dragon helper or something like that. Mm-hmm. How easy is it to sort of move those things around?
Yeah, it's really just looking at it in terms of, like, what's the story that you want, what's the scene you want to set, and what do you want to do with those NPCs? I mean, the rules really, if you look at the rules for skill challenges as sort of a starting point, that's something that tries to be as flexible as possible. To really say, like, if in your world, like, gnolls, you can make an alliance with the gnoll chieftain. You know, we didn't want to make very specific rules for that, precisely because we didn't want to shut down any story opportunities. We wanted DMs to feel that they have a lot of ownership.
Right.
You know, one of the interesting, someone described the fourth edition as, like, it's this, like, tightly designed combat system interspersed with very free-form role-playing. You know, so you have this very free-form role-playing approach, then you go into a fight, and it's very tightly defined, then you leave the fight, and you're back to this very free-form approach. And that is something that I think is a strength of the game, in that we don't want to dictate to you, really, the details of the world, or, like, this is exactly how gnolls feel about, and this is exactly what, outside of a fight, this guy does, because we want to give the DM license to give training and a skill, or say, this is what this guy is like, or this is how you can approach this tribe of goblins in a non-combat way, or you know, in my world, the sort of mafias are actually, it's like this bugbear clan that lives in the city,
right.
and this is how these guys work. And sort of really let DMs find their way with that, instead of trying to be like, here's that same rigid sort of deterministic approach applied to the sort of story elements of the game.
So related, because you mentioned skill challenges as being sort of a big part of that, I know you've heard all about this now, like, you know, there's these long threads about the math, but, you know, like, someone like me who is really not interested in delving into the math, who really just wants to know, like, can I still use skill challenges?
Oh.
Like, what's, you know, or is there some advice getting them how to use how they're intended?
So the big advice, the two things I would do is don't be afraid to kind of come up with your own structure. Just kind of think of, well, what's logical in this situation and flow with that. Like, if the party is talking to the Baron and negotiating, okay, it's okay if the dwarf fighter with the charisma just doesn't say anything, doesn't take part, you know. Or maybe as a DM, find, well, how can I get him involved without using the
right.
traditional, you know, skills? And just looking at the DCs, you know, the DCs in the book are a starting point. Your specific characters, you know, be aware of, you know, what they're trained in, maybe the general, what their stats basically look like, and build your DCs off that. You know, if you want to be about a 50-50 chance, you just take the bonus and add 10, and that essentially gives you a, and it's Sunday, so my math is
sorry, right.
But it gives you like a 55% chance of success. So that'd be kind of like a, you know, exactly. You know, that's, you know, the DCs are a starting point. Don't be afraid. Don't feel that you have to use those DCs and you're doing the game, doing it wrong if you
right.
don't.
It's not like one of these finely tuned things that it's going to
exactly.
go way off. Yeah.
Because really the important thing is just how you're managing the table and what's going on. You make the rules serve you, not the other way around.
Right.
Yeah.
So, following that concept, how about magic? Any advice for, like, giving out magic items or doing magic items?
Yeah, the I mean, generally the guidelines in the book are, you know, it's the guidelines in the book are basically like, you know, if by the time you go to for first to second level as a group, you'll have like a fourth, third, second level item, or and a first. Maybe I can't remember. I always forget the exact numbers, and that's a good starting point. One thing to keep in mind, and if you just did that all the way through, you'd be fine. But one thing to keep in mind is that within, like, you know, a first-level character could have, like, an extra first-level item. You know, it's not that big of a deal. That's why we gave them the items levels, was to give you a sense of, like, what's appropriate and who should be carrying this item.
Mm-hmm.
And for higher-level stuff, you know, as long as you're aware that, you know what, this whoever gets this, like, you know, the second-level party is a 10th-level item I gave them, whoever's getting that might outshine the other players a little bit. It's not catastrophic, because since items tend to fall like the daily power, you know,
right.
Okay, so during one fight, he's going to be a little better. And maybe it's a hack bonus, it's a point or two higher. But as long as you're aware of that, you know, especially if you're just saying, you know what, in the story, like, hey, look, this, you know, the first-level fighter, he inherited this sword. You know what, I'm going to do something crazy. I'm going to make it the 18th-level sword. And you do have, like, the +4, you know, flaming longsword that your grandfather used.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, as long as you're aware of that. You know, one of the most enjoyable 3rd edition campaigns I played in, I had, like, a 5th-level dwarf fighter with, like, a +4 battle axe and +3 flail and wings of flame. We had crazy
right.
amounts. And it worked, because the DM, you know, he just took into account and wrote the adventure. He didn't, here's a +5 sword, and I'm just going to pretend it doesn't exist.
Right.
And wonder why you're hitting,
and then
you know,
the monsters are being destroyed left and right,
Or the rest of the party is kind of jealous, like, well, you got the really cool loot. Why are you, the monsters never hit you because you have the +7 plate mail or whatever. And so as long as you just keep that in mind, and as long as your story calls for it, well, then make sure your story supports that.
Yeah.
You know, that it's there for a reason, you know, and it makes sense in the world.
Yeah.
I think people are pretty forgiving of the mechanical end of things if in the game it makes sense and the story is moving along and the campaign's still fun.
And it's not totally overshining someone else. I think that's the big complaint against for game balance is that, you know, somebody just shows up other people, but
exactly.
Probably not going to do that anymore.
I mean, a lot of it's just using the right approach based on your approach to the game. If you are running a very by-the-book game in a game where it's like, okay, it's going to be a lot of fighting, we're going to use the rules a lot, then yeah, you want to stay within the rules. But the more you're like, you know, I feel pretty comfortable doing whatever, then the more, you know what, we don't need to be as strict with the rules, because we're not playing the strict by the rules game.
Right. Cool. Yeah. So, in general, can you talk about anything you're working on, or at least have in the pipeline?
We've got, let's see.
Here's an easy one. How about the next two Heroic Tier adventures? Can you say anything about those?
Oh, yeah. So we got Thunderspire Labyrinth. Thanks. I was like, oh, my God, what are we doing? I can't remember. We got Thunderspire Labyrinth coming up next. And then after that is Pyramid of Shadows. And they're both very traditional dungeon adventures. So it's going to be a lot. Kind of the first adventures we release for a new edition will generally be like, get back to basics, get
right.
people, here's classic D&D. Thunderspire Labyrinth, though, what I think is kind of nifty about it is Rich Baker came up with this idea for, he's the co-author of it. You know, there's this sort of Underdark trading post beneath this, in this dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of go there and use that as your home base. And you're like living alongside like Duergar and other Underdark critters that come up to trade, and it's sort of a safe zone. It's kind of like a Berlin kind of, you know, immediately after the war or something like that. These little factions control it, and this weird, mysterious group of wizards runs things and mets out justice as needed. And then you use that as your springboard to go on different adventures in this mammoth dungeon complex.
So it's not necessarily linear. You have like a bunch of different branches that you can sort of go in.
It's not as branched as maybe we could under us. It's a little linear in the sense that you go here first, then you go here next. It isn't a super dungeon in the sense like, hey, it's underground. Where do you want to go? East or west? And from there. So, but it's essentially, you could think of it as like three small scenarios linked together. Like, go and deal with this problem first. Okay, now you hear about this. Oh, and that points you toward this, and then you go 1, 2, 3 in a sort of order.
Okay.
It's been interesting with writing the adventures. Pyramid of Shadows is a very similar story dungeon adventure. That one has a little bit more within the dungeon, kind of where do you want to go next and explore and poke around and the different groups in the dungeon, how they interact.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I'm really hoping to see as we go forward with, especially like Dungeon Magazine and stuff, we have, I think, the general feedback has been the way we presented these modules so far. We've only seen one release, but with H1, people seem to like the Delve format in the sense of these two-page spreads, but you know, you can just read straight through. You're not flipping back and forth a lot.
Right.
And what I'd like to see us do then is take that idea of, hey, what's a good format for a dungeon? Okay, well, now what's a good format for a mystery? What's a good format for an urban adventure?
I see.
And find new formats to fit the other type of adventures people want to play. Because we know people don't want just dungeons all the time.
Mm.
You know, they said that's like your classic. You want to offer that, but you don't want it to offer just that. So I've been kind of thinking of some ideas for some classic adventures and just some other stuff.
And you might try out some new formats and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I've been thinking about that
ideas.
A lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like one of the, you know, if you think of classic adventures, like, hey, what's, what, you know, keep on the Borderlands, what kind of format would you want for that? And maybe, okay, what's what we have already, but then what about, the GDQ series, you know, the Vault of the Drow? Well, that's a lot of it's you're wandering around this Drow city trying not to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
What's a good format for that?
Right.
You know, it's not really a spread format because you're not... well, you know, do you go into, like, this shop and attack the people there? Well, no, so it seems kind of weird to have a tactical map and all this stuff. But how do you let the DM organize that?
Have all the information that he needs to run that kind of encounter.
Exactly.
So you're mentioning these classic adventures. I know you did, like, a panel on classic adventures earlier. I thought it was interesting something you said earlier that, you know, 4th edition rules had to be able to recreate these classic dungeons. So is that sort of how you define, like, what D&D is to you? That those classic adventures can be done?
I think D&D is what you do in the game. Mm-hmm. And I think what you do is that sort of stuff that Gary set down back in the 70s. I think it resonated with people for a reason.
Yeah.
You know, I think people like this idea of, like, this weird, like, underworld environment you go into, and there's, you kind of, you know, you're sort of the heroes carrying the light into the, you know, the darkness and seeing what's down there and strange slithering creatures, and it's, I think a lot of it just taps into, like, sort of gamer culture in a way, like, you know, gamers love Cthulhu,
right.
You know, and what's better than going down to Cthulhu, you know, fighting Cthulhoid creatures in this creepy realm, and,
right.
You know, and I think that's why that stuff resonates, or just this idea of, like, the Drow City, you know, it's, that's just really cool, you get to sneak into the city, and it's not just, you can't just attack it.
Right.
You know, you're sort of
way outnumbered. Yeah,
exactly. Drow are nasty, and so you got to be, you know, diplomatic toward them, and, you know, and that's, yeah, and it's just the nifty thing. Well, and the Drow fight amongst themselves. So there you go, perfect hook for you to get in. They don't just kill you; they try to use you. How could you be useful to me in taking out this my rival over here and back and forth?
Right.
So making them much more than just the bad guys you punch in the face.
Right. There's actually a blog that we're sort of linked up with. It's the Musings of the Chatty DM. He wrote a couple series of posts about how a lot of the old adventures were not just running and kill because you're way outnumbered. Like, they're more about getting the factions to fight with each other because, you know, you're going to get easily killed. Like, this is the only way is to be creative. Do you want to sort of bring a lot of that sort of back?
Yeah, I would love to do a conversion of G1.
Yeah.
Where you have, okay, it's a fort full of giants. If you kick in the door and attack, you're going to get killed.
Right.
There's way too many of them. But there's, you know, you can be sneaky because they're having a celebration. They've been drinking and they're kind of distracted. So maybe you can pick a few off. Or maybe you can go to the dungeon beneath the steeding and find the orcs who are rebelling against the giants and ally with them. And, okay, allying with the orcs weren't maybe the most trustworthy guys, but you kind of have a shared enemy.
Right.
And, you know, or just doing clever things like, okay, we'll set the steeding on fire to drive people out, or we'll use, you know, a clever trick to, hey, we'll get an audience with the chief, you know. I don't know, we're emissaries, some, you know, IUs or something. We're here to form an alliance with you, and they got a skill challenge to run and get the guy alone and kill him,
right.
Or turn his lieutenant against him. Oh, no, we think, Mr. Second in Command, you'd make a better leader.
Right, so we can help out with that, yeah.
Exactly, and really get, and that's what I think, I think there's a tipping point when people, the first time, I think people can play D&D for years and doing a very, like, oh, dungeon crawl and fight monsters and stuff. But I think for a lot of people who really get into D&D, there's that tipping point the first time they do an adventure like that. And they go, whoa, what did we just do, right?
Right.
And that is what gets you into it, you know, and really hooks you in that this is not like any other game where if you come up with a clever idea, you get to implement it and see if it works.
Right. And then possibly deal with the consequences.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Fallout when it comes.
Right.
And it will come.
Right. For you, your personal gaming, I know it sort of blends together at some point, but, you know, what are you running? What are you playing?
Sure, I'm playing in a Forgotten Realms campaign.
Mm-hmm.
I'm running a Greyhawk campaign. It's my lunchtime game. I run it twice a week. And that's the Greyhawk game. The Forgotten Realms game we play on Mondays, though with schedules we haven't played in a bit. Too long, I want to play again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get to play this game much. That's one thing. I got to play on Friday night, and it was great, because we beat Encounter 3 of Keep on the Shadowfell.
Oh, yeah.
So people come to me and say, hey, we can't beat it. I'm like, well, if you can beat it.
Is that the one with Iron Tooth?
Yep.
Yeah.
We got a little
killed
lucky.
Us off.
Yeah.
Almost.
That's a pretty tough fight.
Yeah.
And we got a little lucky. We also had like 6 or 7 players instead of the 5, which helped a lot.
Right.
And but yeah, that was pretty fun. And it was the kind of thing where, like, when he went down, everyone was cheering.
Because
I had like no healing, 3 hit points left and no healing left in the party. And I'm playing the Dragonborn fighter. And I'm these stupid kobolds that I just can't. I keep missing them.
Well, you designed them. I mean,
yeah.
No one else to blame.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's true. It was funny. We were playing, and I'm like waiting, okay, when's Iron Tooth going to show up?
Right.
I'm not saying anything because no one else knows. And I'm just like, okay, I'm the big, dumb, 8 intelligence Dragonborn fighter. I charge those kobolds.
Right.
And I'm just going to play my character. But it was like, oh, there he is. Oh, and he starts, there's the rogue. And now the rogues catch up.
Right.
So.
Cool. Well, probably have to wrap up here shortly. Real quick, can you, because we are Critical Hits, any, like, memorable Critical Hits that you've got?
Oh, let's see, my most memorable Critical Hit. Oh, that, so I DM a lot.
Uh-huh.
So, You know, I'm going to turn this out. I can't think of a good memorable critical hit off the top of my head, but I can remember a few critical failures on a saving throw. I was playing in Jason Bowman's Eberron campaign, and we were all running through this gate, and there's this giant clockwork dragon, and his, like, clockwork dragonlings are these three big, huge monsters, and we're like, we can't beat these guys, so we all have to run. There's this gate we need to run through. Everyone can run through except for the cleric, who we have to leave behind. Oh, God. Uh-oh. So you feel kind of bad, but it's like, yeah, but if we know if we stay behind, this other character's going to die. So it's the cleric's turn. He's like, okay. And we're like 9th, 10th level or something like that. I cast Sanctuary, this kind of crappy first level spell.
Right.
If you're not familiar with it, it's in order for you to attack me, you have to make a saving throw. So we cast Sanctuary and starts walking toward the gate, provoking the attack's opportunity. And the first saving throw, 2. And that's one of the little guys. Next little guy. Oh, like a 5. Oh, fail. Okay, the big guy. Okay. This guy can only fail on a 1 and 1. And the cleric... Actually, I think he spent a few rounds just standing there taunting before he walked up.
Right.
But yeah, that was pretty memorable. Because we all thought, oh, we're going to lose Adzo, our poor cleric is going to die. And, hey,
defeated by a first-level spell. Yep, so, it happens. That's D&D.
That is D&D.
Yep. All right, well, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Cool, thanks for having me. Yeah, that's good. Cool. Yeah, thanks.